Demonology and the Triphasic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 11. Dyadic Coping Strategies. The kindest man she ever laid eyes on was currently sitting in her waiting area. He was sitting in her waiting area, and he was wearing Crowley's sunglasses. It was a jolt to her system to see him there. She hadn't expected to see him. He hadn't called ahead of time. He hadn't set up an appointment. He was simply there. And she had to wonder how long he had been waiting. He looked up and towards her as she stood in the doorway to her office. He smiled. She could feel that smile in her stomach, in her throat. But it wasn't like before. It was a small, little smile, not like before. It was nothing more than a greeting. That smile. It felt like the edge of a knife wrapped up in layers of gauze. "Miss Time," he said, and he stood. He looked like he was about to walk towards her, and he even took a short step in that direction, but then he stopped. "We have met before, if you recall." Yes. Yes, she did recall. From her perspective, standing in her doorway, Aziraphale's presence, despite Crowley's absence, was both a good sign and a bad sign. It was a bad sign because it meant that, however Crowley was doing, it was dire enough that Aziraphale had sought her out. And he had sought her out, she could only assume, without Crowley's knowledge. It was a good sign, on the other hand, because it meant, however dire Crowley's situation may be, it wasn't so dire that Aziraphale was completely bereft, completely undone. It meant, at the very least, that Crowley must still be alive. She had done her due diligence, as much as she could. She had called, she had left voicemails. It was all that she could do for a client whose circumstances were as unusual as Crowley's. For the 2 weeks since Crowley had left, his name had kept showing up on her schedule during his regular slot. She didn't know how. She hadn't scheduled those appointments, and it wasn't an automated system. She had assumed it was some sort of jab aimed at her, and it made her feel something other than pissed off. For both of those 2 weeks, she had waited the customary 15 minutes for him to arrive, and then she had left a voicemail saying he had missed his appointment. That was all there was for her to do, for a client whose circumstances were as unusual as Crowley's. Aubrey Time took the imaginary card on which she had written, "I'm a fucking hack," and she made sure it was safely filed away in her card catalog. It was cross-listed. It was filed under S for self, under H for hack, and under Crowley. It was filed away, and there were 3 separate locks she could turn to make sure it stayed filed away.
"May I have a moment of your time?" Aziraphale asked.
He looked scared, and he looked nervous. In her memories, he wasn't the sort of creature who could look scared or nervous. She made herself focus on the feeling of the gauze, and she tried to ignore the knife's edge below it. "Sure," she said. She stepped back into her office, held the door open for him. "Come in." She didn't really want him to come in. She didn't want him in her office, not given how he had been in there before. But it was the only thing to do. It was the only thing to do, so she invited him in. He gave a small little nod of his head, like he was grateful. It was strange thinking that a creature like him could be grateful towards her, grateful for something as simple as an invitation into her office during her business hours. He walked in. She could not tell if there really was a change in the air pressure as he passed by, or if that's just how it felt to her.
"I hope you will not judge me rude for keeping these on," he said, with a gesture to the sunglasses,
As if he thought that the therapist who used to meet with Crowley weekly would be unaccustomed to sunglasses worn in her office. I thought that these might... He stopped himself. Started again. Well, as it was last time, I thought... Thank you, she said, not interrupting as much as providing an act of mercy. That's very thoughtful of you. Aziraphale was not her client. She did not have a therapeutic relationship with him. But still, he was in her office. He was a person in her office, and she could tell that he was scared. She could tell that he was nervous. She was a professional, and she had substantial experience working with those who were scared and nervous. She had substantial experience working with the loved ones of her clients, when they had reason to be scared and nervous. Go ahead and have a seat, she said. There were, in total, 3 chairs in Aubrey Time's office. The 2 armchairs, which were the primary focus, and a computer chair over by her desk. Aziraphale paused, and she watched as his attention moved from one of the chairs, to the next, to the third. He was so hesitant. He was so unsure, as if he was scared that this was some sort of test, and he didn't know what would happen if he made the wrong choice. Aubrey Time could be patient. Her next appointment wasn't for an hour and a half, so she could be patient. She could be patient, so that he could make this decision at whatever pace he needed to feel safe. Ultimately, he sat in the most obvious chair. The chair that just about everyone sat in. He sat, in other words, in Crowley's chair. She realized as he sat that she didn't want to sit across from him, so she kept standing. It is, I must say, a bit of an experience, wearing these, I mean. He was talking, she thought, because he wasn't sure what to say. I never much considered what it must be like wearing them in an environment such as this. I had always just assumed... She could tell by how he was sitting. He didn't know what to do with his hands. In her memories, he wasn't the sort of creature who could be self-conscious. Well, I suppose you must know why I'm here, he said. I think so. But I also don't want to make any assumptions. And also, she winced quickly, because this would be an unpleasant complication. I have to tell you, I don't have permission to tell you anything. I can listen to what you have to say, but I can't even confirm or deny whether someone is a client of mine. Oh. Crowley would have laughed at her. He would have laughed in her face, or sneered in that way of his. He would have been unrelenting until he got her to acknowledge how ridiculous it was that she would refuse to acknowledge what they both knew was obviously true. Aziraphale had been here before. He had been here before with Crowley. This legal formality really was ridiculous, and Crowley would have pushed until she admitted it. Aziraphale, she saw, simply accepted it. I can give you the paperwork for it, she said. You just need to get a signature, and then I can talk to you. Paperwork? He said, like a question. She nodded. It's just a simple release of information. Just a single page. It just needs the signatures. The paperwork was simple. But she had a strong suspicion getting the primary signature would not be. Oh, well, one of his hands fluttered up to the sunglasses, started toying with them. He wasn't comfortable in them. They didn't fit his face. In that case, could you check again? What? Your files, he said. His tone grew more certain. Could you check to see if you already have that paperwork on file? She knew she didn't. Just, please, do check. He nodded his head, like he was hopeful, like it was worthwhile for him to be insistent on this matter. It wouldn't hurt for her to check, so she would give him this. She walked over to her file cabinet, unlocked it, opened it to the correct folder. She kept scanned copies in an encrypted folder on her computer, but for Aziraphale's sake, she thought it would be best to search in a way he could easily see. She flipped through the documents she had on file and she found it. Or at least, she found what she assumed was supposed to be it. "This isn't," she frowned. She looked back at him. "Is this in Latin?" "Oh, right, yes. We don't do that anymore, do we?" He didn't sound entirely perturbed. "Do check it again. Perhaps you simply misread it." Fucking demons and angels. She looked back down, and yes, he was right. The document wasn't in Latin. It was in English. Some sort of English, at least. It was in English, and it had something that looked a lot like her signature. And it had the mark that was undeniably Crowley's signature. "Well, how about that?" she deadpanned. "You see?" he sounded so hopeful again. "So easy for something like that to simply get lost in the shuffle until you have a chance to go look for it." "Right," she said. If it had been Crowley in the seat, and if the need for proper documentation had been established, the lack of it would have been the end of discussion. Aziraphale was different, though. Crowley had insisted on playing games by his own rules. Aziraphale, she understood, did something different. It was what she needed. It had the signatures, or close enough. It was in English, or close enough. It was the veneer of respectability that she could use to allow herself to do what she had wanted to do in the first place. She had put the document back in the file, closed it up. She thought about moving back over to the two chairs, but she decided against it. She didn't want to keep standing. It felt wrong. But she also didn't want to sit in her customary seat across from him, where she had been sitting the last time he had been there. That, too, would have felt wrong. So she sat, instead, in the computer chair by her desk. "Okay, let's talk," she said. "Tell me what's going on." Her desk wasn't angled to make it easy for someone sitting in his chair to see her. Had it been Crowley in the seat, he would have pushed it around to face her, or he would have snarked at her until she moved, or he would have simply stood up and paced. Aziraphale didn't. Instead, she watched as he twisted himself sideways in the chair, bending his neck so that he could face her. It looked uncomfortable. She wondered whether angels could feel uncomfortable. "This is all my fault," he said, and he looked like he was in pain. He couldn't keep from toying with the sunglasses. It was so obvious he did not like wearing them. "I'm here because, well, I was wondering, do you ever do house calls?"
"No, I'm afraid I don't," she lied.
"Might you reconsider?"
He kept toying with the sunglasses. It looked almost like a compulsion, like he didn't know how to stop it. They didn't fit his face, and it was so very obvious that angels could, in fact, feel uncomfortable, feel painfully uncomfortable. He looked so scared, and he sounded so hopeful. He sounded hopeful in a way she understood. It was the type of hope one feels when the only other option is desperation. He was the most powerful fucking being she had ever encountered, and he was here because he had nowhere else to turn.
"Look," she said, and she worked to get her voice to hold sympathy.
"I think you can take those off if you want."
"Are you sure?" he said.
He was the kindest man she had ever laid eyes on. "Keep them nearby," she tried to smile, "but I think I'll be okay." He was as hesitant with this as he was with anything. She didn't remember him seeming so hesitant, not when she had seen him with Crowley, although she had to admit she hadn't seen him much, and her memory from that day wasn't reliable. She waited for the time it took him to pull at the sunglasses, to remove them. He did it with his eyes facing downward, and he kept his eyes aimed downward as he folded the sunglasses up. He kept them folded up, cradled in his hands. She realized they were precious to him. They were Crowley's sunglasses, and so of course they were precious to him. Aziraphale was hopeful because his only alternative was desperation. He looked up, and she stifled a flinch. She hadn't needed to flinch. She was fine, at least for now. She could see his eyes, and they were just kind eyes. There was gauze covering the knife. She thought, perhaps, that there was something he was doing to keep his eyes simply kind. Or she thought perhaps there was something he had been doing that previous time, and now he simply wasn't. Either way, she could tell that he was both grateful and relieved to no longer have the sunglasses on. It was so strange to think that he was someone who could feel both grateful and relieved because of her. They had work to do. "Tell me about his condition. How is he?" she asked. A form of muted distress flickered across his face, and then he said, "He isn't sleeping." "Okay." She didn't know what to make of that. "I thought neither of you actually needed to sleep." "No, that is, yes. Yes, you're right. But you see..." This was the point, she thought, when Crowley would have interjected in order to speed the conversation along. But Crowley wasn't here, and Aziraphale had to manage it on his own. She had to wonder, if she had met Aziraphale first, if it were Aziraphale she took as the constant and Crowley as the other, what would she be able to see that Crowley lacked when Aziraphale was not there? "He's acting like he's sleeping. He's in bed all the time. That is, in bed, or close enough. But he isn't actually asleep. I can tell." She nodded. She nodded in order to say, "I'm listening." She nodded also to say, "I trust your judgment." He was not her client, but she had a professional's eye for observing and assessing those who came into her office. She had a professional's capacity to tell what type of nod someone who came into her office needed to be given. "Has he ever done this before?" she asked. "I'm not sure." "Why did you say this is all your fault?" "What?" He was confused, just for a moment, until he was able to follow her. Then he looked pained. "Oh, it is, isn't it? I should have... Well, I had simply thought. I had simply thought new world and all that." She had no idea what he was trying to say. She had thought earlier that an hour and a half would have been enough time. Now she wasn't so sure. "I'm going to have to ask you to clarify that," she said. "I should have known better." "Huh?" "He's always getting mad ideas and running with them, isn't he?" "Uh-huh." "And I know how that goes, but I have thought." It was much harder to be patient when she was listening to somebody who wasn't a client. "I don't know what you're trying to tell me," she said. "Oh!" Now he seemed surprised. He seemed surprised, and it seemed to distract him from his nerves. "Forgive me, I simply assumed you knew. I had rather thought this was something he had spoken to you about." "Get out with it already," she thought, but then she felt bad for it. She hoped he couldn't tell. "You see, we have just been talking through the prospect of moving in together," he said. Jesus fuck, she thought. And then she really wished that she hadn't thought that. It didn't even mean anything, and she wished she hadn't thought it. She wished she hadn't thought that, and there was something else that she needed to think about. There was something else, many other something else's, in fact, that she needed her mind to be able to think about. "To be honest with you," she said, and she was putting a lot of work in keeping her expression plain, "I thought you two already did live together."
Oh, well, was he starting to blush? Did angels actually blush?
"Perhaps, as a practical manner, most of the time, we still do have our separate spaces."
"Okay, okay."
She let herself open and close her jaw a few times, letting her teeth bite down onto each other, so that it would be easier for her to think.
"Who first suggested it?"
"He did, of course."
"Of course."
"When?"
"I suppose it was a few months ago now."
He tried repositioning himself in his seat, but there wasn't much for him to do. She had made it so he had to twist sideways to see her, so he would have to contort into an uncomfortable position to see her. She had done that to him. She tried to work through the timeline. It was vague, but not that vague. It was a pretty obvious timeline.
"Jesus fuck," she thought again,
and she really wished she would stop that. It is important for a psychotherapist, like Aubrey Time, to remember that her clients' lives never stop. They continue on with their lives, making choices and changes, flourishing and floundering, despite all the work within her office. And sometimes, because of the work within her office. It is easy to forget this, to become comfortable, to become complacent. So much of what happened here, in this room, could be flashy and showy, easy to see and focus on, and it could be hard to remember that it was only 1 hour per week of the client's whole life. It was only 1 hour per week, and there were so many other hours. There were so many other hours, in particular, when there was a whole month between one session and the next. It was easy to forget how much more there always was in a client's life, and it was easy to rely on the client to bring up anything from all those other hours that needed their joint attention. It was easy to fall into the trap of expecting a client to be honest and open. Anthony J. Crowley, that terrified, traumatized, victim shaped like a demon, son of a bitch, had never, not ever, been honest and open with her. She had seen him for a liar when they first met. She had seen that he was hiding, that he was always hiding. And then, at some point, she had allowed herself to forget this. She had allowed herself to stop looking for his tics, for his tells, for every sign that there was more below the surface that he wasn't willing to let her see. She had allowed herself to forget that he held deep down inside him, secret, anything that hurt too much, or had the potential to hurt too much, anything and everything that mattered to him, everything he was too scared to let out. She had allowed herself to forget that his honesty had always been his currency, and he had always doled it out as a pittance, only ever in the way that let him feel in control and thereby safe. She had allowed herself to forget. She had a card tucked away. She had it filed away. She had it under lock and key, cross-listed under S and H and Crowley. He had suggested, in fact, that we might move out of London, Aziraphale said. He looked guilty. He sounded hopeful in the way that masks desperation. We had talked about a cottage, someplace nice, perhaps in the country. Jesus fuck. She had pushed him to start processing his fall. She had pushed him to acknowledge it, to talk about it, to think about it. She had pushed him to confront his fall, right as he had been trying to crawl his way to the heaven he was terrified he couldn't deserve.
Fuck, she thought.
Okay, she said. She took a deep breath, and she turned her head to the side. She turned her head to give herself a chance to find a path, to find a route, to think and strategize. And then she turned her eyes back to Aziraphale.
Okay, she said again.
She had handouts. She always had these handouts. She kept them close. There were the handouts that she gave to her clients' loved ones when she thought it was necessary. They were the handouts she knew could be terrifying and frightening. They were the handouts she knew that were less terrifying and frightening than the circumstances that led to her giving them to her clients' loved ones. She collected them, and then she scooted her computer chair away from her desk, closer to him. She had a script. A script she followed when she had to give these handouts to her clients' loved ones. It wasn't a perfect script, and it was a script meant for humans. But it was a script, and scripts were comforting.
I want you to know, she started, and she knew how to make her voice.
It wasn't her soothing, calming voice that meant this is serious. It was her voice that meant this is serious, but I'm here with you and you can trust me. She knew how to use this voice. She knew what she could do with this voice. I understand how difficult this is for you. I understand. It's not fair that you're in this situation, and it's not fair that you're going to have to be strong enough to get through it. But you are, and you can, and I'm here to support you. Okay? She saw his eyes widen. They were scared eyes. She could look into scared eyes. And I also want to make sure you understand, she went on, that it's my job to worry about all the ways that things can go wrong. That's what my job is. So, right now, we're going to talk about worst-case scenarios, and we're going to talk about safety precautions. He looked stricken. His eyes went wider, and he looked stricken. She took a deep breath. It was the sort of obvious, theatrical deep breath that was meant to get another's attention. She could look into the wide, stricken eyes of someone who was scared. This is just about being careful, she went on. This was serious, and she was here for him, and he could trust her. Again, just safety precautions, because it's my job to think through worst-case scenarios. You get me? He nodded. She saw how he nodded, and she thought that he had done it just because she had asked a question of him, just because he thought it was what was expected of him. She thought he hadn't nodded because he actually wanted to. He hadn't nodded because he actually got her. She watched as his fingers flexed and curled, compulsively, unrelentingly, around the sunglasses he still had in his hands. You're strong, Aziraphale, she understated. She could tell he didn't know it was an understatement. Now, I am going to have to ask you some questions, and we're going to have to work together. The questions I have weren't meant for people like you and Crowley, so I'm going to have to ask you to listen closely, and you have to let me know if there are questions I should be asking instead. He was listening, but he was struggling to process it. He was struggling. She knew how to sit. She knew how to sound. She knew how to look into another's eyes, as if to say, "It's okay if you're struggling, because I'm here for you, and I'm not struggling." "Okay?" she asked. "Yes," he whispered. First question. Does he have access to any firearms?
What?
He seemed confused. Right. These questions weren't meant for people like him. This is America. Sorry. That's always our first question. I guess what I mean is, does he have access to anything he could use to hurt himself? She saw the answer. She saw it in his eyes. She could always look into the eyes of someone who was terrified. Second question, okay? Second question. Can you hide it from him? He was thinking slowly. He was too terrified now to think in any way but slowly. She understood it. She was used to her client, who would speed up as much as he could, and he could outpace whatever might upset him. But she was faced now with someone who slowed down as much as he could to evade whatever might threaten him. It was a matter of pacing. It took him time to understand her question, to work through it, to think out the answer. But then he nodded. He nodded to her, and so she nodded back to him. She was working to keep him with her. Okay. Third question. This isn't forever, just a few more questions. That's all. She nodded to him again. She could keep his eye contact. Third question. What are you going to do to take care of yourself? That question, she could tell, he couldn't parse. He couldn't make sense of it. She could tell. She could tell that was a question that had never occurred to him before, that he had never thought to try to answer before. He wasn't her client, but he was in her office, and he was seated before her, and he was terrified. And she couldn't help but see him as a child who had never been allowed to learn how to ask for his needs to be met. She couldn't help but feel all the many different ways her heart could completely break open. She couldn't help but feel that way, but it wasn't her job right now to let it show. "This is hard," she said. "This is very hard, and you're going to need to take care of yourself. That has to be a central part of our plan, Aziraphale, so that's where we're going to start first. Okay?" "Okay," he agreed, and his voice was small and wavering. He was the most powerful fucking being she had ever encountered, and his voice was small and wavering. He reached for a tissue, all without putting down the sunglasses, and then he dabbed it against his eyes. They had practical matters to attend to. They had work to do. She had handouts to explain to him, to give to him, and they had contingencies to work through. She had to help him develop a self-care plan. This was her job. Aubrey Time may have a card, hidden under a lock and key, filed away under S and H and Crowley, but she still knew she had a job to do. She had to excuse herself at one point to ask her next client to reschedule. It was okay because it was Maya, and Maya was low risk. Maya was very low risk, and she had been very low risk ever since her sister had been found miraculously alive and well all those months ago after having been lost at sea for years. Maya was low risk. And so it was okay to ask her to reschedule, because the schedule for a professional therapist like Aubrey Time was always structured, first and foremost, around the matter of risk. When they were done, when Aziraphale was grounded, when they had a plan and she felt she could safely let him leave, she watched as he stood. She watched as he walked to the door, as he held those sunglasses fierce and tight in his hand. She watched as he hovered at the doorway, and he looked so scared and hesitant and unsure. She watched him, and she could not understand how a being like this could have existed for as long as he had and still not known that he was good, that he was good enough, that he was more than good enough. That he was good just exactly and precisely as he was. "Aziraphale," she called out to him as he hovered in the doorway, hesitant and unsure. He turned to look at her, and he had eyes that she could look straight into without fear. He wasn't her client, but he was a person, and he was suffering, and she needed him to understand that he could be brave. "You're stronger than you think," she said, and she meant it, and she knew it was true. "I believe in you, and you know Crowley believes in you too." So much could pass across his face, all in an instant, and it was enough to break her heart completely in two. 45 minutes later, her office phone lit up. It didn't ring. There was only one phone she had in her office that had its ringer turned up, and it wasn't her office line. But the office line would light up when it had a call, and she recognized the international code, so she answered.
"You frightened Aziraphale," he said. His voice was thick, sleep-drunk and groggy.
Aziraphale had said he hadn't been sleeping. That wasn't good. "He was already frightened," she said.
"I don't like people who frighten Aziraphale," he said.
The good thing was she could make any number of faces and roll her eyes as viciously as she needed while talking on the phone.
"I'm glad to hear from you," she said.
There were thick and slurred sounds of annoyance, and then the call disconnected. Her arms wanted to shake, but she wouldn't let them. Her jaw wanted to clench, but she wouldn't let it. She took deep breaths, and she kept her eyes on the clock. 15 minutes. That was her standard. She would call him back in 15 minutes. She didn't need to, though. It was less than 20 seconds before her other phone, rang. It was the phone whose ringer she always had turned up, the only phone she brought into her office and which she would allow to ring. It was her cell phone, the one which was never supposed to ring. It was the cell phone whose number she gave to her clients. She answered.
"I said, I'm glad to hear from you."
He was sleep-drunk and groggy, despite the fact that he had apparently not been sleeping. He was sleep-drunk and groggy, and that meant that a phone call like this could take a very long time.
"I called you," he said.
"Yes? Yes, you called and I answered, and I'm glad to hear from you." He had called her. She had told him before that there was only one sort of situation when he should ever call this number. She had told him before that there was only one thing it would mean if he had called this number. This phone's ringer was always turned up because this was a phone she always answered. This was a phone she always answered, and she wouldn't hang up so long as it took. She would keep him on the line. She would make sure he would talk. She would keep him on the line, and she would keep him talking, and she would keep it up until she was sure that he could see that there was a way for them to move forward. This was her job. This was the sort of thing she was trained to do. It was the sort of thing that no training in the world could ever make one feel professionally prepared for. It was the sort of thing that always, always made one cross list cards under S and H. But it was her job, and it was what she was here to do.